reminds me of a question that I had for you, though, Jack. What kind of levels do you monitor at in the studio, and have you noticed any issues as time has gone by?
Well, funny you should mention that. This is the monthly journal of the American Tinnitus Association, which I encourage you all to go check out, ata.org. I actually do not have much of a tinnitus problem right now. In 1994, I did briefly. I had a pretty big scare with some tinnitus that didn't seem like it was going to go away. And I got pretty serious about doing the research and taking care of my health and changing some lifestyle factors. And the tinnitus went away and it stayed away. And one of the things different about how I work now versus how I worked in 1988 is levels at which I monitor. I think there's still, I run into people occasionally who say, man, Jack, you used to do everything just like incredibly loud in that little studio. His reciprocal had a tiny little control room and the speakers were like right there. And I'd be like, ah. And, you know, somehow I would mix for hours and hours and hours at a time. And, you know, after about 7 or 8 hours of that, if that, your hearing sort of turns to mush and you're just kind of guessing at what the high end is on your mix. You know, I learned to not do that. And now I probably monitor at about 85 or 90 dB most of the time. In other words, not much above loud conversational level is usually where I monitor 95% of the time. Sometimes very quietly. Like when I'm mixing, for hours and hours will go by when I'm not monitoring much louder than I'm talking right now. And, you know, occasionally there'll be some big speakers or whatever. I'll throw the mix up on the big speakers and, okay, let's see, is the kick drum there? Okay, are the speakers moving? Do I see the NS10 woofers actually becoming a blur? Okay, the kick drum's loud enough. Turn the volume down again. And, yeah, it's funny you should mention that. I became a member of ATA when I was really just curious to learn about the tinnitus issue because, of course, doctors will tell you there's no cure for it. We don't know what causes it. We have no idea what's going on, and you just should take care of yourself. Let me get audience participation here. I'm curious about this. How many of you have had an experience whereby one ear or the other spontaneously just starts ringing for no reason? Just boop. Okay, has anyone had any, have you ever been able to discern any reason why that happened?
Angels.
Gamma rays.
Okay. Now, when that happens, do you notice that your hearing actually drops in acuity at the same time? Like the high end seems to go away for a short time? Now, generally, when that happens, it'll come back in a minute or so. Sometimes faster, sometimes slower. Well, in 1994, I had a period of time, and granted, this was when the grunge thing exploded, and I was very highly in demand. I was working way too hard and not taking care of myself, not eating very well, not sleeping very well, and drinking an awful lot of caffeine. I started having these instances where my hearing would literally, the ring would happen randomly in one ear or the other, and all of the high frequencies would just get sucked out and disappear. It is the exact same thing that would happen back when I was a little kid and I'd be throwing firecrackers. And, you know, every now and then you light one and you go like this, and it goes off in your hand. You got some little firecracker, maybe it makes you finger sore, but you're deaf in that ear for like several minutes, if not longer. Well, it got so extreme that I would have it happen in the middle of a mix, and I would just have to get up and leave the room and say, I need to take a break for about 10 minutes, and I would just go out and sit quietly and just pray that my hearing was going to come back, and it always would. There was one point when it was bad enough that it actually woke me up in the middle of the night. Out of a deep sleep, one ear suddenly went boop, and I woke up just thinking, God, this is bad, this could end my career. So I cut most of the caffeine out of my life entirely. I don't drink coffee anymore. You saw me drink coffee tonight, Steve. It's the first time I've had a cup of coffee in months, just because I needed to be able to think on my feet. Normally, I don't have to do this sort of on demand. And my ears may ring a little bit because of it. Another thing which I don't do, which has been shown to have something to do with that tinnitus thing, a lot of it, there's a theory, this business with the ears doing that. The theory is that it is based on vasospasms, meaning tiny little blood vessels in your ears that suddenly go like that for whatever reason. And certain foods, certain supplements, certain things in your diet can cause that to happen more or less. Magnesium is one that causes it to happen less. It is a relaxer of blood vessels. Caffeine has been shown to cause it to happen more with some people. Tobacco is a horrible thing. If you're smoking, you are actually more likely to lose your hearing sooner than you would otherwise just from aging alone. There's also studies that have shown that people who are enjoying the sound exposure that they're having suffer less hearing damage than people who are not enjoying the loud sound exposure. So there's stress aspects involved as well, which may have something to do with decreasing blood flow to the ear. The less blood flow there is to the ear, the more of those hair cells you're going to lose is what it amounts to. So, make a long story short, I started taking a lot of vitamins, a lot of antioxidants, a lot of B-complex, controlling what I ate, less salt, less fats, less sugar, and 10 years later now, it doesn't happen. Now I get those little things like maybe once every few weeks I'll get a little, kind of like what any of you probably have, just randomly. I do have to be careful if I so much as sit down on a drum set and go like this on the snare, my ears will ring for about a minute. If I clap my hands in front of my face, like I could do it loudly, there'll be a little tiny ring for a few seconds. So my ears have sustained some damage over the years, and I have to be careful about it. But anyway, ata.org if you're curious about it. It's $35 a year, and this informative little magazine comes out 4 times a year. And I still keep up my membership just because I like to support the research because they're trying to find cures. And a lot of people have way worse problems with tinnitus than what I had. What I had and what you guys have all raised your hand is called spontaneous tinnitus, spontaneous intermittent tinnitus. And nobody knows what the hell causes it. I've just given you the theory. There's a lot of other kinds. Like if you were shooting guns, there's like full-on noise damage tinnitus. There's certain kinds of vascular tinnitus that people get where they can hear their heart beating, and it makes a sort of a rumbling sound that is in sync with your heartbeat. That would drive you crazy. Some people have tinnitus that sounds like white noise, which would be very distracting if you were trying to mix a record, I'm sure. So I take care of my hearing. And actually, the second most important piece of equipment that I carry with me at all times is earplugs. I've carried earplugs with me to every concert, every club show, every band rehearsal, and riding airplanes, and sometimes even in cars, since the 70s. I always have these with me at all times. And you can get like 30 of these in a bag at Walgreens for a couple of bucks, and they're wonderful. These are like rated 32 decibels. Ever since I saw Led Zeppelin in the 70s, and at the Kingdom, and I couldn't hear for about a week afterwards, I figured, okay, that's it. I need to, be careful. So, you got to protect the family jewels, and that's, in my case, that's these. These are what I make my living with. So, I still have pretty good hearing for someone of my age, or at least so the ear doctor tells me. So that was an interesting question anyway. It was a good question. Everyone has to take care of their ears or you won't be doing this long. Now, the whole irony of the production career is right about the time you get really good at doing this is probably when your hearing starts to go. But that's the irony of being a record producer, especially in rock and roll. But I still have my hearing. Hopefully I have some mileage left in me, as a friend of mine said. So with that, I'm going to point out my favorite piece of equipment that I carry around with me with... apologies to Steve, who is trying to get his students to use their ears and not their eyes. But I am very fond of this piece of equipment right here.
The microphone?
This is for you, Tom. This is a spectrum analyzer, and I usually have it... This is basically a speaker for my eyes. I usually have it connected across the stereo bus, usually to the left channel only, of whatever studio I'm in at any given moment. And I generally have it connected to the monitor sense, so that if I solo a channel, what gets sent to here is the solo, not the mix. It's very useful if my ears are tired and I'm wondering if there's too much sibilance in a mix. I can pretty much see if there's sibilance in the mix by just what the lights are doing over here. One of the things I used to do when I first got this thing, and this is made by a local company, Audio Control, I have two of these. that one lives in a studio where I work and the other one gets banged around as I, it's sort of more portable. I used to watch CDs through this thing just to see what people were doing. Like, for instance, I was listening to a Cars record and I thought, that snare drum is really strange sounding. I wonder what they're doing. And I know from, like, my own experience that a snare drum has a fundamental frequency of about 200 cycles. That's, you'll see a bump down here at about 200 cycles, and you'll see the psh, psh, the snappy stuff up here around 2, 3, 4K. The snare drum on the Cars CD that I was listening to, the fundamental frequency was 100 hertz or below. Now, the snare would have to be, like, this big for that to be true. So immediately I thought, they're using some kind of triggers here. Something is sampled. Something's been added in. And things like that that you you work out. I can usually tell if something... This is another thing. A lot of studios now, especially home studios, basements, bathrooms, whatever the hell people are putting their Pro Tools LU rigs in, they're small. They're tiny. And you can't judge low frequencies in a small room. And the reason is the actual waves themselves cannot exist in a room that is that small. Let me look here, because I did the math. Steve, you may be able to help me out here. The wavelength, one wavelength at 100 hertz, what is it, about 11 feet?
11 and a half feet?
Yeah. Okay, that's 100 hertz. Okay, 50 hertz, you're talking 22 feet. That's one wavelength. Okay, fundamental low E on a bass, 41.2 hertz. Okay, so that's probably around 65, 70 feet long is one wavelength of the fundamental low E on a bass. So, and okay, so now you imagine you're mixing in a little room with 12-foot walls. Can that wavelength even, I mean, can that sound exist in any sort of linear manner inside that room? I don't know, but you're not going to get a mix with very accurate low end.
Mark would know. He says yes.
In what way, though?
At that frequency, the room is not a room acoustically. The room is a cavity. It's the same principles that apply in microwaves. The pressure is everywhere. At that frequency, the pressure is everywhere equal within the room at any given moment. You're literally squishing the air in the room, all, the entire room, simultaneously. If that weren't true, headphones couldn't make bass.
True.
It's a Helmholtz resonance.
Yeah. At that frequency, it can't resonate because the dimensions of the room are too small.
So usually there will be some crossover point at which the dimensions come into play.
Davis's book, Sound System Engineering, has a really good, the new version, the beige one, not the yellow one, has a good explanation of that. And there are three regions of where the room acts like a cavity, and then where it acts like a room where you can have reverberation and standing waves and all that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And then there's this transition region.
Right.
And the trouble is, in most rooms, control rooms and living rooms,
where's the transition,
transition region is really important, and that's where a lot of the music and speech energy
is. It usually around 100, 200, 300, something like that?
Yes.
Okay. This is the problem with trying to get your kick drum level right in a small room.
You're right that small rooms are very anomalous, but it's not true that...
The
sound can't exist. It's just that the room is not... You can't have standing waves and you can't have reverberation at those frequencies because the room is acting like a cavity. You're literally compressing all of the air in the room, is rarefying and then compressing simultaneously. At any given instant, the pressure is equal throughout the entire room at those wavelengths.
Would you say that the room can be characterized as flat in any way below that transitional area?
Flat in terms of having equal response, you mean?
I mean, is that area below the is that area where it acts as a cavity? Can you judge it with your ears in any way and get useful information from your speakers?
It will be different than for a given loudspeaker and a given set of ears, it will be different if you move your speaker and your ears into a larger room.
Mm-hmm.
At those low frequencies in a little bitty room, essentially your eardrum is directly coupled to the loudspeaker diaphragm. But that doesn't mean it's going to have flat response in terms of variation.
Now, if low frequencies, of course, not being as directional, Now, this is something I noticed years ago from one studio I worked at had some little isolation chambers, ISO booths, and sometimes we would put a guitar amp in the ISO booth or a bass amp. And I quickly discovered that I would get a much better sound from the bass amp if I opened the door of the room than if I closed the door. If I closed the door, the low frequencies would be choked off in some way. I would get a sound that was all mid-range, and it didn't seem to have any oomph to it. The same with the guitar amps. We took the amp out, put it in the big room, and mic'd it. The tone that actually came in the microphone that got to tape was a much bigger, louder tone in terms of the low end. And that's where I got that idea that there's something about these small rooms that is choking the low end completely and not allowing it to develop. Low end is omnidirectional, which it almost is, from which direction is the wave coming?
The key there is it's choking but not completely. Mm-hmm. What's happening in the larger room that causes the larger room to be bassier is that in a typical room, this one being an example, there's very little absorption in this room at the very low frequencies. The carpet is thin, the ceiling, the tiles that are on the rim of the ceiling soffits is thin. Mm-hmm. So at the low frequencies, this room is very live, very reverberant compared to the mid and upper frequencies. That means that as the low frequency sound continues, it reverberates and it will actually build up in level. The reverberation will build up. So you will have, with typical program material with a lot of bass, the bass will be louder because of that reverberant buildup. Mm-hmm. That cannot occur in a small room because there is no reverberation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No reflections can occur.
Well, the other thing in a small room is when you have, if you had a smaller volume there, your max level of compression would be different. I mean, essentially it would be like adding physical compression to the thing so that it couldn't.
The other thing I would wonder is what is the, if you have a small room and you've got some source in the room that is putting out say 50 hertz or something, you put a microphone in there, but what direction is that low frequency? What's the directionality of it that is going to make the microphone diaphragm go this way instead of that way? You see what I'm getting at here? You literally just have a pressure zone rather than a pressure wave going back and forth in the room. So will the microphone actually respond to it? This is AES business here. This is good. You're clearing me up on something here. I thank you for that.
Well,
this
you're
is
getting
excellent.
Into an area now where I don't know where I'm talking about either.
Yeah.
I think you would be right in the case of a figure eight microphone, but in the case of a closed back microphone, because the closed back microphone is essentially a high frequency barometer.
All right, yeah, I see.
But I think with a does anyone have practical experience with that using a figure eight microphone, ribbon or something?
Wouldn't cardioid be the same thing?
No.
Because it's more sensitive on one side, so even if it's the whole room.
I think you have a point there. If, you're using
that if it's compression completely, it cancels out figure eight.
But a lot of cardioids are mostly or more omnidirectional at lower frequency, so maybe that's another reason why you have less low end, is because it's acting more like an omni.
Well, a practical cardioid that becomes omnidirectional at low frequencies just because of the distances involved in the cancellation ports that are on the back. It's possible to build a cardioid microphone that's still cardioid at 20 hertz, but it's about 35 feet long. So
and it would fit
not too many.
Yeah, not too many rooms.
I think Royer makes one. I have this.
Well, you're getting my point here is that people actually have mastering studios in little tiny rooms, and I don't know how they're doing it, is what it amounts to. This Brazilian CD was mastered by a guy. I went to the mastering session, and the room was smaller than my bedroom. I mean, it was tiny, incredibly tiny. And he did a good job mastering it. I don't know how. You know, you can get used to anything, I guess.
I'd like to ask a question for you, because I'm not a recording person. I design sound reinforcing systems and stuff like that. When you're in a small room, it would seem to me that the bass isn't gone, but the room would tend to behave. It would make me feel like I were outdoors, at least at the low frequencies. Does it do that? Just at the low frequencies, not at the upper frequencies.
That's an interesting point. I don't have any way of comparing that immediately, but I know what you mean about outdoors, because the sound just kind of goes out and disappears, and you feel like there isn't any.
It's outdoors is essentially half of anechoic, more or less.
Yes, yes, yeah. I've played outdoor shows, actually, as a bass player.
You showed one on the...
And, they were doing that. Yeah. I mean, I've literally been on stage doing that myself, and you keep thinking, wow, my amp's usually a lot louder than this. You know, let's turn
it
up.
Well, it is.
It is, I know. It is. Yeah, so there's... There's anyway, just to get to my point, which was that people don't really realize what low end is doing. And one of the biggest variables I find, because I'm freelance, I don't own my own studio, which means I've made records to date in 10 countries. And actually, I just counted, and I just hit 298 records. So maybe by the end of the year, I'll hit 300. I don't know. That's albums and EPs. Singles are a whole other issue. No one cares about those anymore. But the main variable, now you can talk about $1,000 preamps and, you know, this tape machine or that tape machine, or, you know, digital being flat or not being flat, you know, this $1 million mixing board versus this $100 mixing board. But by far, so that other factors don't even come close to it, by far the factor that changes the most from control room to control room is the room acoustics and the speakers. So much so that a CD that you play in one studio will be almost unrecognizable in another studio until you've sat in that studio all day and listened to CDs and you sort of tune into it and realize, oh, that's what this room sounds like. When I got to Brazil, the studio that I was recording in, which was called Mega Sound in Rio de Janeiro, was possibly the worst sounding control room I have ever worked in years and years. And I was mixing there for a very long time, and I found I just had to turn the volume down lower and lower and lower and lower until I could recognize what was coming out of the speakers, because whatever I had to make it seem like there was just me in this. The louder I turned it up, the more the room ambience just screwed it up. And I brought the band in, and I said, Charles, the drummer, who's like the engineer guy in T-Tons, I said, bring some of your favorite CDs in here and just sit down and listen to them with me in here. I want you to see what I'm up against. And he brought some CDs in, and he played them all, and he turned and looked at me and said, Jack, they all sound terrible in here. I said, thank you. That's the problem I'm having, because I was just having a hell of a time mixing in the studio. So to make a long story short, years ago when Charles came to Seattle, he because a couple of the Titãs records we actually recorded in Brazil and mixed up here, he saw this thing and he went and bought one. And so now whenever I go to Brazil, there it is. He's got it. He brings it to the studio and I use it. And what it's nice for is you can see exactly what's happening down here at 20, 30, 40 hertz. Well, 25 anyway. And it's the way, you know, the speakers may change, the room acoustics may change, but I can always take a look at this thing and go, oh, it's too bright. I better be careful. You know, so it conveys information to me. Anyway,
while you're talking about bass, what about bass amps like live, for instance?
What about bass amps? So the other day I had a guy come into the studio with a bass amp, and I sort of looked at it, and he's a friend of mine, so I could give him a bunch of crap. I said, what are you doing playing through this walkie-talkie? It was basically some little transistor thing with two 10-inch speakers in it. And, you know, it kind of went, and, you know, I gave him a whole bunch of crap about it, but, you know, I stuck a mic on it, and we recorded it. And by the end of the session, he had blown up the speakers in it. And he said, well, I just bought this thing, you know, I just wanted to try it, you know, and it, you know, it was kind of loud, but fundamentally, I went down to Guitar Center the other day, and there's all these bass amplifiers, electric bass amps with 10-inch speakers in them. Now, why do the guitar players get 12-inch speakers, but the guys playing bass are getting 10-inch speakers? Maybe one 10-inch speaker or two 10-inch speakers, and the guitar player's got a 4x12. There's one popular bass cabinet, Ampeg makes it. It's the 8x10. It looks like a refrigerator. It's the size of a refrigerator. It's got wheels on it, a big handle. And the fundamental frequency that that thing puts out, the resonant frequency, if you will, is somewhere around 200 or 300 hertz. So people think that they're getting a really, really loud bass sound, which they are. But when I go to record it, you can't tell the difference between low E and the next octave up E. They're both 160 hertz. They should be 40 and 80. And so I wind up having to do all kinds of weird notching and, you know, cutting at 200 hertz and boosting at 40 hertz and just crazy stuff with compression to try and get the bass to line up with the kick drum, which is meanwhile thumping around down here at 60 or 70 hertz. So I don't know what the thinking is of people with these bass amps, but they're very popular these days. I personally like to record people with 15-inch speakers because you actually get a low octave or two, which is kind of the point of having an electric bass. Anyway, that's another rant. Thanks for reminding me of that, Steve. The guy actually went out and bought another. His amp stopped working. We wound up using my bass rig on the recording, and after he heard that, he went out and bought another bass amp, and now he's a much happier guy.
Transient response, probably?
Yes, transient response, and that 200, 300 hertz resonant frequency that the thing has sounds louder because it's more up and sort of up in the audible range. And people think that it's like, it's really, it is loud. It's really loud. It's just at the wrong octave.
And it's 50 pounds lighter.
Yeah.
Oh, the 10-inch speakers versus the 15s?
Yeah, it's not.
Yeah, it probably is. Even 8-10s is probably a lot lighter than 2-15s or an 18. I'm not sure. They're still heavy.
No, it's too heavy.
They're still massively heavy things. I mean, I used to play with a single 15, and it was fine.
8-10s is obscene.
I know, but everyone, a lot of people use them. And I always, when I see them come in the studio, I just kind of go,
they must have roadies.
Yeah, no, they have wheels is what they have, big stations, wagons, and trucks. And, you know, usually when I have that situation, I'll take a DI from the bass and I'll use the DI to sort of give me the bottom octave, and I'll roll all the plinky stuff out of the DI with EQ and just kind of phase align it and try and mix it in with the speaker thing. Let me give you I wanted to do a geek out here on something. I wanted to explain something else that has been consuming my attention lately, and that's mixing with stems. I need to bring this up because for years and years, I was mixing to half-inch, quarter-inch, mixing to analog, basically, and there's plenty of people who still maintain that mixing to a good half-inch Ampex machine is the way to go. Now, I've decided it may be the way to go, but I'm no longer happy with analog because what comes out is not what went in. And with digital, it's a lot closer. Now, what I generally do when I'm mixing digitally, I'm mixing back into a Pro Tools session. I'll have a multi-track Pro Tools session. It's going out the 24 or 32 or whatever analog outputs of the Pro Tools rig to a mixing board, old school, Trident or whatever I've got, going out the stereo bus and back into two channels of the same Pro Tools session. Usually there's a latency of, it's about 83 to 86 samples on the 888s. I'm not sure. The HD rigs, I've seen a latency more like 102 samples. But that's not really here or there. The thing, what you wind up with is a mix that is more or less exactly synchronized with the multi-track. See, here's a session that I did for a band called Optimus Rhyme that's kind of a rap rock band. And there's all the original drum tracks and so forth, bass, guitars, vocals, everything's there. And way down at the bottom of the screen is the mix coming back in and being mixed right along with it. And back in the day when you would mix to analog tape, it's not that far in the past, it was customary to do vocal up, vocal down mixes. Like if you were at all, you get the mix exactly the way you thought was brilliant, and then the idea was you got to cover your ass. So, because the A&R guy is going to ask for a mix with more vocals, no matter what you do. Or somebody may panic later, the singer may be embarrassing. Oh, no, we really need to. Usually it's the guitar player who says we need a mix with less vocals. So you would always try and do one that was like a dB up, a dB down, and then maybe second guess yourself, okay, we'll put the solo up a little bit more on one mix. Well, then we'll have one that's vocal up, solo down, and you wind up with 10 or 15 mixes, and you just chew through reel after reel after reel of half-inch tape. And, you know, maybe they pick the first one you did for 90% of the songs, and maybe one of them they use the vocal up mix. Very, very wasteful. What I realized once I started mixing to digital is I could mix with stems, and it's a term that's borrowed from video, actually. There might be some people here who know a lot more about video than I do, which is not much. But the idea of mixing with stems is you can subdivide your mix into parts, like basically you have just the drums or just the guitars or just the vocals or a whole instrumental track minus the vocals. And then a separate mix of just the vocals. What I would do commonly now is I'll make the mix and it's exactly the way I want it to be. I'll just show you this band. Do we have audio? I guess we'll see.
No.
I don't think we do. We probably still have the DVD plugged in.
No, I think we just turned it down.
I just turned it down. So
That's the DVD.
Yeah. Sorry, push the video button.
Come on.
In between two songs on the T-Pass record right now. It's complicated equipment. Let's see. Much better. Okay, so this is a band called Optimus Run. Now what I found I can do, and I do this all the time now, is I got the mix, that's mix one, and then this is Pro Tools 7.1. I'm used to 6.9. There it is. What we have here is a version of just the lead vocals. Now, what I did.
Avoid fluctuations in the BPMs we employ if the tempo.
Now, what I did is when I do my mix, I do the stereo mix, and then I just mute all the faders and leave everything exactly the same except the vocal. And I run that out through the same master fader at the same volume level, going into the same, I just make a parallel track, it's assigned one and two. So I basically have the exact vocal that was in the mix minus everything else. Now what I did in this case, the band said, we need a version with less vocals. So I said, okay. I took this, and you'll notice it says INVT on it. It means I phase inverted it. There's an inversion plugin in Pro Tools. I phase inverted it, and you'll can watch what happens when I turn that fader up. Nothing but reverb. So, now if I hadn't inverted that, if I'd left it uninverted, I would have a way of making a mix that is slightly louder. What you do is bounce those two together, the computer does the math, combines the two together, and you get your mix with a little more vocals or a little less vocals, or your karaoke mix, however you might be, whatever you might be wanting to do. Now, I actually did something so insane. I had a song a while ago where after I was done with mixing the song, we realized that the vocal needed to be de-essed more than I had done it. And I'd already done the mix. The band, we'd already gone on to another song, and I was not mixing on an automated board. I didn't have snapshot automation, but I did have my vocal stem and my mix. And what I was able to do to de-ess this song, because my ears had been tired when we did it, I was able to take the vocal stem, de-ess it using the de-esser plugin in Pro Tools, and then take that, flip the phase of the unde-essed vocal, combine it with the de-essed vocal. What I ended up with as a result was a phase reversed S's, which I then combined into the original mix and made the S's in question go away. It sounds completely insane, but here is the original vocal. Now this is going to sound embarrassing, but this guy wanted me to make his voice distorted and nasty, so I ran the whole thing through the Sirius compressor, the one with the nuke setting on it.
The distressor,
yes. We had a distressor, and I flicked the switches, and I just hammered it. And he said, yes, that's the sound I want. I want that distorted sound. This is a band from Bulgaria, actually. Romania. They were from Romania. They were called the Moog, and they were over with me about a month ago. And he really loved this distorted sound. Unfortunately, it made everything super essy.
Never reached out things I mean. I know you tell me.
So, now, I de-essed it, combined them together. Here's what you get. And there's a couple real nasty ones in this song. I don't remember exactly where they are, but they were just ripping my head off when I mixed it. Well, they were ripping my head off after I mixed it. My ears were tired. And so, by combining those together with the original mix... the mix after the mix was done without actually doing what the mastering engineer might have done, which is de-essing the entire stereo mix itself and therefore dumping the cymbals and everything else. A mastering engineer has to de-ess it. He's basically just putting a multi-band compressor across it with much sensitivity, right? It's 6 or 7 or 8K. And I was able to just subtract the S's just enough to make the thing tolerable.
Well, Jack, this is automated mix, right? You got the original vocal track on it.
I do, but it's offset by about 86 samples. I was mixing out through a mixing board and back into Pro Tools. The only way you get perfect cancellation is if all the tracks have been going through the exact same pieces of equipment at the exact same levels with the exact same EQs that the mix went through. That means going out through the Trident board, through the fader, back through the stereo bus, with the same compression and EQ and whatever I had plugged into it, only isolated. Now, I have, in a pinch, I've been able to actually go back to the original tracks, which are up above, and I've been able to do things like, just say somebody wants like a little bit of guitar, and I didn't make a guitar stem. I can pull it down there, nudge it over to the right about 83 samples, cross my fingers, blend it into the mix, and make a mix with a little more of that guitar part. And it usually works fine. Maybe the EQ isn't the same, but at least the waves are lined up, and you get the effect of something becoming a little bit louder.
Jack defined stem, because some people are just...
Well, this is what... I don't know how to define... I'm doing, these are stems. The vocal thing is a vocal stem. It means a subcomponent of a mix. I believe.
That's good.
Yeah. I started using the word.
A submix, yeah.
Well, kind of, yes, a submix. A submix. And the idea is you can break down your stereo mix into stereo submixes of what I'm doing basically. I mean, if I wanted to, I could make an instrumental stem, or I could make a stem of just drums, a stem of just guitar, a stem of just bass, a stem of just vocals. And I could theoretically combine them all back together and get exactly what I had in the original mix. It sort of screws it up a little if you are mixing through a stereo compressor. It screws it up a little. But because once you take all the drums out, suddenly the vocals are not all being shoved up and down by the overall compression that the mix might be going through. The drums pushing the vocals in and out. But I don't mix with much compression, frankly. I hardly ever use it. I tend to leave that for the mastering guy. So the implication, anyway, is that once you start mixing to digital, even if you're going out through an analog board, you can do all kinds of things to the mix after the mix is done and the session is over. I was able to do this in my living room, because I had basically all I needed was the mix and a vocal stem. And I was able to just sitting there in my living room with a pair of NS10s, I could instantiate the plug-in, flip the phase, de-ess it, sum it, reverse it, combine it back in. Oh, there it is. And, days later, months later even. The whole vocal up, vocal down thing, it's gone. I don't even deal with it anymore.
Lots of mastering houses now are asking to get the stems, and then they're basically making the final mix. And like Sterling Sound.
I wouldn't say they're asking for it. I would say they're going along with it.
Well, it gives them more hours.
It does. I've talked with a couple, and they don't really like it. You know, they sort of prefer if people kind of get it right, but because, like Rick Fisher told me this, for instance, he says, "Well, I'm not. You know, I don't want to be an extension of the mixing studio. You know, but you know, you can do it. But where do you draw the line?
I only take
you mix and master the whole record at the same time. That's where
some
you would ultimately
do,
end up going.
Which is very strange.
It's very strange. Yeah. But, you know, I don't know. Anyway.
We're getting close to...
Yeah, I don't really need to geek out anymore on this, but I thought you would be interested in this.
Jack, can I ask you a question about that, please?
You may.
So, when the artist comes in and takes a listen to the mix, the original mix that you have, and you've already set yourself up to fix any corrections they may have, or... Basically, is that correct? I mean,
what is the question?
Well, so then do you burn a new mix from these stems right here? Do you
yes.
give them a new mix?
What I do is I assign, as you see, I'm playing it actually, but they're all assigned to track one and two, track one and two, track one and two. I'll select it. I'll go over here to bounce. Oh, look at this.
Oh,
bounce to disc. And it comes up with a dialogue that allows you to choose what's the source. In this case, it's one and two. Now, I better make sure that my kick and snare, which are way up at the top of the screen, that are also on one and two, are muted, or I'll wind up with those getting mixed in with it. But and they are muted, actually, in this case. I'll go multiple mono, 24-bit import after bounce. And I'll bounce it, and then it imports it back into the Pro Tools session. And you look over here, and it winds up right there. You bounce it, you name it, and then you drag it back into the session, which... Actually, as you can see, I've already done. It's this right here. I just sort of dragged it in there so I could keep an eye on it. And anyway, that's the DS one that was made by combining these three stereo stems together. And that's the one that they sent to master.
You have to set yourself up for that.
So between you and Steve, would you clarify for us why it's particularly unusual that the mastering house becomes the mixing house and the mastering house? Is there some sacred rule that says you can mix a record and master it?
There is no sacred rule about it. Mastering is a somewhat different state of mind than mixing, and it's a different skill.
It's different philosophies too. Because for me, the mixing is a time domain function where you deal with verse chorus and get each of those right. And once you get there, you've lost objectivity typically. And mastering is a frequency domain situation where I never want this frequency to be above this level. So the sibilance part. So I take it. Whereas the mixing is linear this way, you look at it this way, I take it end on and say, okay, that S's you have, I target very
yeah.
specifically.
Yeah.
Don't do anything until you get above this level, this frequency. And so psychologically, you know, I don't. It's like a step function. The mix is already done. I can increase its quality and then give it away. I don't have to do all of that. And I'm fully fresh on it. I've never heard it before. I didn't have to remember the 3 or 4 or 5 hours in the studio trying to deal with this horrible musician that you keep hearing.
This is the other aspect of mastering. It's all about objectivity. Mixing after you've spent like 3 or 4 hours on a song, then you're going to master it? You don't know what the hell it sounds like. You know what it sounds like right now, but you don't know what it sounds like out in the world. Mastering is the last step. It's the buck stops here. Part of the thing where it's got to sound good to the rest of the universe, not just the mix, the place where you mixed it in.
And me, so, in mixing too, you want to listen to it on many different systems so you can see what's going on in many systems. For me, I have one system that I know, and I know what it sounds like completely, and then I take that to basically anywhere else, and I know how it's going to sound, but I don't have a cheap pair of speakers that I listen to make sure it's right.
We haven't really answered his question entirely, Steve,
well, actually,
which is that why can't a mastering engineer also be doing some mixing?
Well,
and he can.
That's
some.
Yeah, I guess
you know?
It's where you'd want
to where
draw,
draw
the
line.
Yeah.
I know. Well, does he have to? Now, I did a record years ago. This is a funny story. I did a record for a band called Blue Cheer. Anyone here old enough to remember who Blue Cheer is?
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
Okay. They're actually friends of mine, I can say, which is quite an amusing circumstance. In 1990, I got summoned by their German manager to go to England and record a Blue Cheer album, which, because they were fans of the Seattle stuff. Blue Cheer was a band from the late 60s. Their biggest hit was a kind of acid rock version of the song Summertime Blues, which still gets played on oldies radio sometimes. It's really noisy and cacophonous. It sounds like Hendrix or something. And unfortunately, since they didn't write it, they don't get a whole lot of performance royalty from that song. But anyway, they wanted to make a comeback. Long story short, I did this record for them. The band was happy with it. Everyone was happy with it, except their crazy German manager decided that it didn't have enough reverb on it. So they took the record, and without him telling us, he took it and mastered it in Germany, and he had the mastering engineer add reverb to the entire record during the mastering. So
you might as well call that a mix. You know, really.
Well, yeah, but it's horrible. It's unspeakably horrible.
It has
horrible.
Your name on it.
It has my name on it, and it sounds like the back of the King Dome. You know? It's just with the King, the, you know, R.I.P., the King Dome, sorry. I saw Led Zeppelin in the King Dome, I think I was saying, and I couldn't hear for about a week. And actually, I couldn't recognize any of their songs for the first half of the show because the sound was so bad. But so there's an example of something that should not have happened, because to this day, the band actually played here in Seattle a couple months ago. I got to have a little reunion with them, and we were both totally kvetching about this record and how annoying it is, because they had a big legal issue and they don't deal with this manager anymore, and they can't get the original master tapes back, and none of us has a copy of it because the studio didn't have a DAT machine. It was quarter inch, and there's only one copy. I have a cassette. Anyway, whatever. Things that might have been. Fortunately, none of you will ever hear this record. Ever. You will never find a copy of it. It is on such an obscure little label.
Steve, is that addressed then, as far as you're...
Well, I actually already knew the answer to the question, but I know that there are students who, you know, want to master everything they ever mix.
Well, you just slam it through an L1.
That's what I was
going. L1 and then an L2 and then
an L. Yeah. C4 L's or whatever, you know.
More L's the better.
Yeah, the more L's the better. I have gotten to where sometimes I will take my mixes and I will put them through a little. I like Maxim in Pro Tools. It works the same way. I'll throw them through that thing, you know, give it a few extra dB, and then give, like, you know, Mr. A&R guy or whatever idiot needs to hear it, I'll give him that one. And, you know, just so he's, you know, because my mixes are conservative. I'm not running through a lot of compression or limiting when I'm mixing. So the level tends to be very, very low when you hand somebody a CD of, well, here's the mixes. It's like 10 dB lower than what it's going to be when it's mastered. And, you know, you don't want everybody freaking out. So I'll go ahead, I'll run it through an L1, make it a little louder, pretend I'm a mastering engineer for a second and give them that. You know, the band I'll give the real thing to. But anyway, that's another mastering issue. Steve, how are we doing?
I think we're ready. I think we're there.
Okay.
I think what we might want to do is, for just a couple minutes, is any question and answers that you really want to know from Jack, since he's here. He's under the microscope. If anyone ever wanted to ask Jack and Dino searing
personal,
burning
incendiary questions.
When you mix in the box, do you mix with the mouse?
Yes.
Do you think it takes longer that way than using the old-fashioned control surface console thing?
Old-fashioned? What do you mean?
Well, like when you run it through the Trident to get the summing amp on the mains, you're not actually moving the faders on the console.
No, the faders are all basically, if I can get them straight across, I get them straight across.
But
I will use the EQ on the console.
Right, but you're not using the faders to make
moves. To make moves, correct. I'm doing my volume moves in Pro Tools.
So then you're only adjusting one thing at a time. You're not taking two hands and going, oh, I'm going to move this against that.
Right, and I don't have to do it in real time either. I can just zoom in on the part and go, oh, let's turn that up. Psh, okay, done. That's the other thing that's great about not doing 2-inch anymore, is not waiting for the tape to rewind. And being able to just go to the part instantly and say, okay, here it is. No, I usually am... Now, here's the thing with rock and roll bands. You're mixing a rock and roll band, you don't usually have all the faders zooming up and down like this. Generally, one or two faders will be... You know, the vocal will be riding up and down a little bit. Maybe the snare. Maybe the guitar solo gets pushed a little bit. It's not that much motion going on in a typical rock band. They tend to control their sound. A guitar amp, as I've said, is the most extreme compressor known to man. A Marshall amp on 10. There's nothing. You basically record it on screen, and it looks like a brick wall. It's just, there it is. And, you know, drummers tend to be somewhat dynamic. God bless them. But you just don't necessarily have this kind of thing going on. And even the moves that you are making inside Pro Tools may only be 1 or 2 dB. So I'm not too worried about losing resolution or whatever people might get all freaked out about with doing, you know, doing volume adjustments in Pro Tools. Oh, you're doing some math on the signal, but whatever. I can't hear the difference. So yeah, I'm using the Pro Tools for automation.
So are you using the mix window or the pencil tool?
I never use the mix window.
Yeah.
I don't even know why it's there. I was
you
just
see the faders.
Yeah, but you've got faders right here. If I need a fader, there's one right here, you know? Here's my fader. You know, what do I need?
You can't watch it move.
It's
well,
fun to watch them move.
Yeah, I know, but you know, the fader moving is taking up more CPU cycles.
So I can't hear it.
Well, I can't hear it either. But I mean, on some of my computers that I get stuck with sometimes, it's like, well, close that mix window and get rid of all the plugins you don't need and turn off whatever you're not using and the computer will be happier. Yeah. But yeah, I know, it doesn't matter that much. But I never use the mix window. It's... I don't know. It's just a whole new way of working. So, questions, anyone?
Yeah. So, to continue with his question, when you find yourself mixing in the box, do you find that you take a lot more time with headphone mixes or getting volumes right for each of the musicians so they can play off each other a little bit more naturally? You know, because you're not going to have the ability to reach out and move two or three faders at a time if you need to. Do you find getting a more natural mix for headphone mixes, or do you...
I never use headphones, period.
Never.
So I'm not sure what your question is.
Oh, the musicians. He's talking about the musicians.
What you're tracking.
Oh, you mean... Wait. What's that got?
That's tracking, that mix.
That's tracking.
In tracking. Yeah, sorry about that.
And I've only done a few things by mixing entirely in the box.
Okay.
Meaning, and it's incredibly tedious. It takes forever. You've basically got to duplicate this elaborate patching scheme with buses and inserts and all the stuff that you would normally do in a real... console, you can do it inside Pro Tools, and it takes a lot of mousing. And I certainly wouldn't try and track a session that way. I still got to have my mixing board just to be able to make the headphone mix for people. Yeah, that, I see the question you're asking. You can do it in Pro Tools. It's a huge pain.
It's a pain, though.
Yes, it takes forever. But you know, maybe my work methods have not fully evolved. However, I probably just don't know how to do it yet.
So, is what you're saying when you do the part where the musicians are playing, and I'm not a recording guy, so I don't know what that is.
It's called tracking.
You're using an analog console and...
Sure. I'm just using the Pro Tools like a 2-inch machine.
Yeah, okay.
Just basically using it as a digital 24 track, as it were, or 32 or whatever. That's what I'm doing most of the time.
How could you explain the difference in sound between the analog tape and recording to Pro Tools? Do you hear a big difference? Is it more hi-fi?
It's huge. It's not necessarily more hi-fi. It's quite the opposite. I find analog to be very unflat. What goes in is not what comes out in a real big way. Real big way. And, you know, I can prove that to you right now. If we get the hell out of here, I'll show you a couple of other things. If I can just stop looking at the mouse over there and look at the mouse on this little screen. It's very. Hello.
So you've recorded to analog and digital simultaneously and compared the recordings?
Yes, I have actually. In fact, I've mixed to analog and digital simultaneously and compared the recordings. And it's really a matter of taste which one you like better. Analog does something, it basically is, you know, this is a really old topic, and I'm really not the expert on it, because the analog versus digital thing has been beaten into the ground, and I don't really need to contribute to that. But I personally like, and here's what I'm doing when I'm mixing digitally: I'm actually mixing through the converters and back out again, and that's what I'm listening to the whole time as I am mixing. I'm literally mixing to the converters, so it's not a matter of, okay, I've got my analog mix and then I mixed it to digital and play it back and go, oh, it doesn't quite sound the same as what I was hearing. No, I'm actually monitoring through whatever converters I'm using at any given time. So I'm actually listening to the end result, and that's how I do my mixing. So what I'm hearing is exactly what the CD is going to sound like, rather than, oh, I'm going to like run it to analog tape and warm it up. It's like, if I want to warm it up, I'll warm it up now with, you know, plug in the LA2 or the 1176 or whatever I need to do, or overdrive the channel on the Trident or whatever. Digital is basically more accurate. I hate to say that, but it's I get exactly what I want back from it.
And analog tape is basically an effect for me now. And it's a good effect sometimes, but you have to remember it's an effect. It's not accurate. I'm trying to, this tiny little screen is freaking me out. Hang on a second. There we go. Let me open something for you. I have two more things to show you, and then we're out of here. I can just... Yeah. Hello.
It's on the desktop, right?
Yeah, where's... Ah, thank you. Yeah.
The desktop's probably going to be under the Jack and Dino desktop.
Okay. Desktop documents. Okay, wait a minute. It's on the hard drive. It's on the hard drive. Here it is. Probably all. Give me a second if I can just find where the hell it is. There it is. I'm going to try and pop open my website here and navigate to something. Bingo! There it is. Not on the internet. Where is the tape machine response curves? There it is. This is the article that, well, long story short. Here's some tape machine response curves. This is basically sending flat signal in and measuring what comes out of the tape machine. The blue line is 15 IPS. The red line is 30 IPS. And you can see that it's 20 hertz to 20K, plus 4 at the top, minus 8 at the bottom. The phenomenon at the left is called a head bump. It's a characteristic of all analog machines. This is an Atari MX-80. This down here is an Ampex MM-1200. Almost plus 4 at 30 hertz at 15 IPS. So you can get a really thumping kick drum sound on that machine at 15 IPS, whether you want it or not. At 30 IPS, that particular machine, you won't get much of a kick drum sound because it's rolling off everything below 60 hertz very, very steeply. So your kick drum will be more thup-thup instead of thump-thump. And some machines are much worse about that than others. That's an MM-1200. That's a 2-inch 24 track. This one was way out of alignment. Someone had under-biased it, so it's very trebly here in 15. The head bump is crazy. This is just some of the examples in which, you know, some of the reasons why analog and digital are different.
These are all kick drums?
No, these are just, this is actually, I've literally put tones from, like, the bottom to the top, like every third octave, into the machine, and I measured them coming back out. Wow. And then I drew them on a graph. I basically took data points by putting 30 and then 40 and then 50 and then 63 and then 80 and whatever from a spectrum, I mean, a frequency generator that I have. I used to use a test CD sometimes, too, same thing. And I just feed it into the tape machine and watch what the meters did and write down where it played back and take data points and then graph them by hand, slowly. And this is what results. So what that curve means is you put a signal at zero, meaning the meter's all the way up, into your tape machine at 20 hertz, and it comes out in minus 8 here under that particular condition. Or you put a signal in at 150 hertz, 160 hertz, at zero, and here's where it comes out, at 30 IPS, plus 2. Now this plus 2, minus 2 thing you may think isn't that much, but multiplied by 24 tracks of audio that you're mixing together, it can really make your mix sound quite different. You'll suddenly realize, well, my kick isn't fitting with the bass the right way. The guitars are kind of tubby. What's up with it? Oh, there's a huge hump at 160 hertz. Oh, I've got to thin the unit of changing the EQ that you're doing. So it's really important to know this stuff because, you know, you can really... Different machines sound dramatically different from each other. Here's a Studer A80, much flatter than some of the other ones. Way down here is a Studer. This is the Studer 827. It's pretty much the top of the line of the last series of 24-track analog machines that were manufactured. It's also one of the flattest and just has the smoothest frequency response of any of them. It's still a little bit lumpy, but, you know, what, 1 dB?
And here's the point, too, Jack, is that when I'm mastering, I'll go up and down by a tenth of a dB.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yes, you can hear the difference.
Totally.
You can hear the difference, but you're a master
guy. Kind of thing. This sort of is a little shocking, actually.
Yeah, plus 2, plus 3, yeah. Minus 8.
So that's what I get a fix.
This stuff drove me crazy because when I first started recording, I was recording on an Atari MX-5050 half-inch 8-track machine, which is down here somewhere. Where the hell is it? There it is. There's the 5050 that I did bleach on.
So look at that. Look at that hump over there. So that kick drum is pretty thumping on that record. It's got a big trench at about 130, 140. I was used to that. The first time I recorded anything at 30 inches per second is this little 8-track, which I started my career on, only records at 15 and at 7. Don't even ask me what it looks like at 7.5. The first time I recorded at 30 IPS, it was on a Tascam 16-track 1-inch machine. And first thing I thought was, where did the low end go? What happened? Where's my kick drum? Am I losing my mind? And it was literally that the machine was changing the sound so drastically from what I was used to. Where is it? That's the one that was really... It's this one. This one here. I tried recording at 30 IPS on this machine, which is the Redline. Everything below 70 hertz is just gone. It's not even there. And it was really demoralizing, actually. There were a few records I made on that machine before I realized I needed to go back to recording at 15 on this 1-inch machine. This was, again, early reciprocal recording. We didn't have very good gear. I had to deal with, you know, what I had. And you see the blue line there is a whole lot more similar to my good old 8-track machine down below, which is right there. And then for what it's worth, there's a Studer half-inch 2-track. There's a Sony half-inch 2-track that was actually pretty good. An Ampex ATR-102, I think that was at Studio X maybe, this red line here. 30 IPS, it's still flat down to almost 30 hertz. It's a great machine for mixing to analog. And then finally at the bottom, there's a typical frequency response of a digital converter. It's flat as hell. And there's my last comment. Anyone have a Stevens, Lyrex, Saturn, Soundcraft, 3M, or any other less common tape machine, send me the curves and I'll put them up on my website. So far nobody has taken me up on that though.
Before you go away, show your recording studio, David.
I will. I'm going to go right to it.
Is what you just showed us on your website?
Yes. Okay. This actually is the website, except it's on a local disk right now.
Right.
Hopefully this will click to it. There it is. Unfortunately, the screen is too small, but we'll see what happens. This is the website that I maintain, which has a list of all the Northwest studios.
It's in here.
Is it Endino.com? Endino.com, but this is actually recordingstudiosearch.com, although it's a subdirectory.
There's a link to it, though. From
yeah, there's a link to it. Here's your 84 listings for Seattle. Each one of these, you go to it, there's contact info, basic recording equipment listed for each one. So you can see, look at the categories, and you can see. I distilled it down to exactly what is the minimum information that I need to know about this studio. Who's there? What do they got for machines? What do they got for a board? What do they got for speakers? And how many tracks are they capable of recording? And how the hell do you get a hold of them? So, and it's fast because the whole thing runs locally in JavaScript on your desktop, which is another story. Some of them have logos and deluxe listings. Here's the full propaganda where people put client lists and everything. I actually charge a small fee for them to put the deluxe listing in like this. The regular, those are the ones that are in bold. It's like $30 a year. So about 10 or 15 people pay me for that, and then I take that money and just run some ads in the Stranger with it. And so it basically breaks even, and I spend about an hour a month maintaining it. That's Seattle. Here's Tacoma and Olympia. Bellingham has got a few. There's Binary. Anybody remember Bob Ridgely? He's been up there a long time. Cascade Recording, which is now Cascade Productions. I need to change that. Portland, I've got about 44 there. There's Larry Crane from Tape Op. There's his studio. I think he might be moving to Arizona or something. I'm not sure.
That's what he says.
Yeah, but he's going to keep the studio in Portland. Go figure. Vancouver, I've got a few. Most of them don't really. Idaho. So that's it. You can see that I pretty much just, I stay away from, I don't even try unless studios in L.A. I figure that's not Northwest anymore. And besides, there's probably 1,000 studios in L.A. and I don't want to deal with it. So, you know, but every now and then I get listings from San Francisco and parts further north. And here's this guy. He used to live in Seattle. At least somebody. He's not. He actually is not listing his own name here. He's just listed the engineers. Does anyone remember?
Is that Rick Kiefer?
Yes, that's the guy. That's the guy. Do you remember who Rick Kiefer is? Who can tell us?
What?
Sure.
Rick Kiefer.
What about him?
Well, I got an email from the guy after I started this website. He said, "Hey, I used to have a studio in Seattle. Now I've got a studio in Hawaii. Can I be on your website?" And I said, "Well, okay, I'll make a Hawaii category for you." You know, he's the only one listed. But apparently this guy was, what, in the late 70s or something?
85th yeah. Greenwood. He had a great little studio up there.
So next door to the drugstore,
yeah.
On 85th, around 85th and Greenwood.
Uh-huh.
He had a studio there, 24 track. 24?
Yeah, 24.
Yeah, Ampex MM-1200.
I love the machine.
He was always into building his own stuff, so he started out with a console that was made out of Spectrasonic stuff, and then he somehow convinced Mike Clicker to do a heart project there, and so he built another console there. I had a hand in doing the circuit board layouts for it.
Mm-hmm.
And Dog and Butterfly was recorded there.
Here in Seattle at that studio?
Yep.
Yeah.
Really?
Uh-huh. Absolutely.
Wow.
And two Hendrix tunes were mixed there.
Interesting.
And I guess another bit of oddness was he mixed to a Revox A77.
Terrible machine.
Consumer.
Terrible machine.
Like the consumer
yeah.
one.
Oh, dear.
A good consumer machine.
It's an awful machine. We had one at Reciprocal in the early years. Yeah. It had a terrible frequency response. Everything came back all dull and weird. And
And the line inputs got whacked down to mic level and shoved through the mic preamps. And the mic preamps had serious headroom issues.
Well, you deal.
Yeah.
his studio.
You make
Hawaii
the record with the equipment you've got.
This is the second iteration in Hawaii.
So now, wasn't it C West?
It was C West.
It was C West?
Well, he moved C West to Honolulu.
No, he moved C West.
There was something. You're right, actually.
Seattle West.
Right, to C West.
Yes, I could be wrong about this. Maybe he's disappeared, but I thought this was the same guy.
It's the same guy, I'm telling you.
Yeah.
Didn't he have a
change
remote
his name?
Drunk?
Yeah.
No, his name isn't on the website. If you call that phone number and you ask for Rick, he'll answer the phone.
I think that might be him.
That's his house.
Lucid Turtle? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where's the board? Oh, none listed.
Yeah, he didn't give me much info, really. I mean, Logic Audio Digital Performer.
His name's not there, though.
No.
No, so, he might have... Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, you get the idea. Oh, and there's a Mastering Studios list, but there aren't as many people on it. And look who's on top!
By putting Ars Divina, because I'm Ultraviolet Studios, but it's under the umbrella of Ars Divina.
How come
it
begins with A?
Huh? Well, let's try, because I don't pay him anything. Thank you. That's good.
Well, why did Jack, what's his name, pick AAA Triangle Studios?
Who?
Bruce Weaver?
Yeah, Weaver?
Jack Weaver.
Yeah. So it'd be in the phone book first, I'm sure.
Bingo.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, yeah.
Any other questions for Jack? At the time?
I have a personal question, and that is when you're sitting there with your pencil tool in your living room, mixing your records. Are you mixing records by the per the track cost, or are you doing by the per the hour cost?
I'm not mixing records in my living room. I'm mixing records by the hour in a real studio for the most part.
By the hour in a real studio.
Yes, exactly. Or by the day, or by whatever the hell deal I've worked out. Now, the mixing entirely inside the computer, without access to an external mixing board, I've only done that once with an album. And it was just like a favor for somebody I knew that had no money at all. And I went ahead and did it in my living room. Is basically looks like a control room. I've got a pair of, KRKs and an MS-10s and a big old honking Sansui stereo from the 70s with a volume knob that big on it. And because it's loud. And it's the little Digio One rig is there, and I've got this old blue and white G3 with an upgrade card in it. It's 900 megahertz, and it works just fine on OS 9. And by the way, there's a website called OS9Forever.com, which has all sorts of interesting cracks and ways of running OS 9 on computers that aren't supposed to do it. It's kind of funny, but whatever. Okay. RecordingStudioSearch.com. JackandDino.com if anybody wants more of this nonsense. Because where am I?
Where's that life story at? Oh, God, it goes right to my record. We don't want you to read that. Here we go. So, yeah, there's the discography, blah, blah, blah. I think you can go through the whole damn thing.
It's too frightening. Don't do it.
I know. It's kind of terrifying. At least it's by year, anyway. This is the funny thing, because I can tell right when things slowed down here, because last year I did something like 32 records, and in 1996 I think I did 5. But, you know, a couple of them were major label records. But anyway, whatever. You get the idea. Punk rock.
Commands.
There was a big record for me, the Ha Ha Heat album. That actually did really well. All over the world, actually. Well, Europe and here. The rest of the world doesn't know about it. So, yeah, anyway, you get the idea. So, AES.org, jackandino.com, recordingstudiosearch.com. So, if you all get out of school and you're desperately looking to become interns, there's your resource. Every damn phone number is in there of every studio in Seattle that has any reason to be known about. And a few of them actually do still take interns. Avast, I think, will take interns. Bob Lang will take interns. Studio X will take interns. Basically, the big studios. The little studios are like one-man operations, and you won't have much luck with them.
Good. Thank you.
There you go.
Very much.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.